August 2nd, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are here in the Valley of Fria, Chapter 12, or as we like to call it, Part 2, Chapter 5, The Darkest Hour. Again, this is a phrase that's been used so often, and it's a pretty easy metaphor, right? The Darkest Hour.
I'll be playing Winston Churchill.
But this is really, really dark, you guys. Oh, my goodness. Super dark chapter?
How many more people can we shoot?
This is a very American chapter. A lot of gunfights.
And pretty graphic description compared to what we normally get. I mean, even just think about the fact that in the British section at the beginning, we found out that the initial murder of John Douglas was very horrible. That's what we were told.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, so horrible that one couldn't identify the body. But it was said in this very British, reserved, you know, double-barreled, sawed-off shotgun in the face. You're going to have to imagine it's not nice. This is like, oh yeah, we're in America. There's blood, there's screaming. It's a very, very graphic, quite different feeling to it.
But Doyle, is he making a statement about the United States? He possibly is.
I think he's making a statement about dime novels, you guys, right? So he is writing this in the style of the dime novels. And he, as we went through the canon, we saw him take up that dime novel ending a little bit more, where he would be like, and here, not every story, but in some stories, he would say, and here's what happened to each of the characters. Da-da. This one went to prison. This one died accidentally. This one went to an insane asylum. And
Bluto became a senator.
Exactly. And this one was happily married, and the victim is just fine.
But, and they lived happily ever after.
But here is the first time I think that we get that darkness of the dime novels with the much, much more graphic violence.
What was really driving that? Because we did go from, I guess, books, and that certainly would not have addressed this much violence. I mean, it is... almost, this is tame in compared to some movies today, but it certainly, this had to be much more graphic than the 100 years before.
What they called midbrow or highbrow literature, this would have been totally unacceptable. Way detail and violence. But for the dime novels, this was pretty normal.
I wonder what the era of the serial killer had to do with this, because the Americans and the British both got through a serial killer right at about the same time here with Jack the Ripper and with the guy who went by Holmes here in Chicago in the late 1800s. And I wonder how much the blood of the news bled onto the storytelling part.
I think that's a really good point. Of course, the violence of the dime novels is available even before that serial killer figure. So in the 1860s and 1870s.
So maybe that's what led to the serial killers.
Now. I don't know that we want to get into that discussion.
Okay, fine. Let's get into the discussion of this chapter then. This chapter opens strongly. There's a very lengthy opening paragraph here. Yes. If anything had been needed to give the impetus to Jack McMurdo's popularity among his fellows, it would have been his arrest and acquittal. That a man on the very night of joining the lodge should have done something which brought him before the magistrate was a new record in the annals of the society. Already he had earned the reputation of a good boon companion, a cheery reveler, and withal a man of high temper who would not take an insult even from the all-powerful boss himself. But in addition to this, he impressed his comrades with the idea that among them all, there was not one whose brain was so ready to devise a bloodthirsty scheme, or whose hand would be more capable of carrying it out. He'll be the boy for the clean job, said the oldsters to one another, and waited their time until they could set him to his work. It's a great paragraph.
Well, and once again, we get this idea of how quickly and how fully Jack McMurdo has really incorporated himself into the secret society, which he has just joined. And he's become such a full-fledged member.
So for Steve, he's the chosen one.
He is kind of the, you're right. He is, you are the chosen one.
They let him in the council, but he won't have a vote, right?
I think some of the notes here are really important, that he's a really fun guy, a cheery reveler, a good boon companion, but he's also totally bloodthirsty. So there are these real contrasting features to this really charismatic guy who will not even take an insult from the boss, Bodymaster McGinty.
Mm-hmm. We get into a little bit of zoomorphism with McGinty here, or as I like to call it, McGintyism.
I really liked this. So this is with regard to McMurdo. McGinty had instruments enough already, but he recognized that this, McMurdo, was a supremely able one. He felt like a man holding a fierce bloodhound in leash. There were curs to do the smaller work, but someday he would slip this creature upon its prey. Now, who else have we heard compared to a bloodhound over the past 100 and some days, my friends?
Could it be Sherlock Holmes?
Right? So isn't this interesting, this description of McMurdo as a bloodhound on a leash? And here, the bloodhound's not the detective. It's someone that you throw at your bigger prey. You've got like other, like, softer dogs to do the smaller jobs, but the bloodhound is for the big prey.
Yeah, that's really good metaphor. Again, it's easy. Zoomorphism is one of the easier metaphors, and Doyle uses it to great respect here, but the curs will do smaller work, and then we've got the bloodhound for the big jobs.
Let's bring in the German lady.
Eddie walks in. Eddie Shafter's father would have nothing more to do with McMurdo, nor would he allow him to enter the house. Eddie herself was too deeply in love to give him up altogether, and yet her own good sense warned her of what would come of a marriage with a man who was regarded as a criminal. So she goes to his house.
I love this scene.
Knock, knock, knock.
She didn't knock. She snuck in. She snuck up on this guy. I saw this at the beginning of the scene, and I went, geez, that's a really bad idea, Eddie. Sneaking up on this guy might end in a tragedy.
I feel like when you're dating a criminal, you should always be that cute girl who comes up and puts her hands over his eyes and goes, guess who? I mean,
What could go wrong?
Well, and this is a girl who's so deeply in love with this guy that everyone says she shouldn't be into, that she's making very, very bad judgments. So one morning after a sleepless night, she determined to see him, possibly for the last time. Yeah, right. And make one strong endeavor to draw him from those evil influences which were sucking him down. She went to his house as he had often begged her to do, and made her way into the room which he used as his sitting room. He was seated at a table with his back turned and a letter in front of him. A sudden spirit of girlish mischief came over her. She was still only 19. He had not heard her when she pushed open the door. Now she tiptoed forward and laid her hand lightly upon his bended shoulders.
Young love.
Yeah, I was really nervous here. Reading that paragraph, I was like, oh, a sudden spirit of girlish mischief came over her. She was still only 19. That's good writing that really sets the stage. It certainly allows us to forgive her for this. But at the same time, as a reader, I was going, oh, he's going to kill her.
Right. And I think it's interesting that he has often begged her to come by his house. My friends, that was not really cool in 1875. You don't have a lot of young ladies visiting.
It's a modern world, I guess.
No, but that is actually, that's very much like against the code of conduct of the day. Even in 1915, the British wouldn't be super impressed with that. So
sure.
You do have this notion that he's not treating her with the respect that a young lady should have.
Well, he's Irish and he's in America. There's two things against him, right, Boyle?
She sees him reading a letter, and as some young ladies sometimes do, she gets very jealous of this idea of he's hiding something from her. Her suspicions became certainties. "It's to another woman," she cried. "I know it. Why else should you hold it from me? Was it to your wife that you were writing? How am I to know that you're not a married man? You, a stranger that nobody knows." Oh.
Well, like Holmes, McMurdo is married to his job, I guess.
And he says, "Listen, this is Scourer's work, and I cannot show it to you. You know, I belong to this society." And as he's explaining this, and she believes him, he does again try to justify belonging to the secret society. He says, "Well, dear, it's not so bad as you think. We are but poor men that are trying in our own way to get our rights." So once again, sort of making this conflict a battle between labor and capital instead of a battle between criminal and detective.
Again, this is something that we talked about probably yesterday, maybe the day before, where we watched a movie where a gentleman was a part of the Ku Klux Klan, and he was just there to protect his business interests. It was not about racism. It was not about us versus them. It was about being a part of a group.
Well, at least at the time, he thought that was the case. And he grew from that, and he eventually denounced that. But you're right, that you know, what we've got right here is, you know, potentially he's working on illegal work. She can't deny illegal work if she sees what it is. And he's got a code that says he has to keep it secret.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Mandalorian code, Steve, just for, if you need some help.
This is the way.
This is the way, Steve. I have spoken.
And Eddie, understandably, once she has sort of accepted that he's not writing to another woman, she's like, "Come on, let's just get out of here. And we can take my dad with us. Like, my dad's not happy here either. It's a terrible place to run a business with the Scourers around." And she says, "We can go anywhere." McMurdo laughed. "The lodge has a long arm. Do you think it could not stretch from here to Philadelphia or New York?" "Well, then to the West or to England or to Germany, where father came from. Anywhere to get away from this valley of fear." McMurdo thought of old brother Morris. "Sure, it is the second time I have heard the valley so named," said he. "The shadow does indeed seem to lie heavy on some of you. It darkens every moment of our lives." This is a pretty intense, dramatic scene.
It's like the darkest hour.
Well, yes. But, you know, we know what ultimately happens. So this is, you know, I don't know, post-foreshadowing?
Yeah. This is not foreshadowing because we know the ending. This is prequel-level foreshadowing. Interesting. She suggests he goes to England. What a good idea.
No one will follow us to England.
Nothing bad ever happens in England.
He goes on to explain how the free men, this larger group, is so much bigger than anything that's actually at the lodge. Even Boss McGinty was ignorant as to many things, for there was an official named the County Delegate living at Hobson's Patch farther down the line, who had power over several different lodges, which he wielded in a sudden and arbitrary way. Only once did McMurdo see him, a sly little gray-haired rat of a man, there you go, there's a little zoomorphism for you, with a slinking gait and a sidelong glance which was charged with malice. Boy, there's all sorts of characters here.
There'll be nothing redeeming about this man. and isn't that what a secret society would do? You would set up, you only know what you need to know, and so you can deny anything above you.
organized crime. This is a very clear story laying out what organized crime looks like. It is very organized.
We'll run away together. We'll go to England.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see how that works out.
And we get more about this organization as we meet Lawler and Andrews. I feel like these characters are super interesting. Lawler was an elderly man, shrewd, silent, and self-contained, clad in an old black frock coat, which with his soft felt hat and ragged, grizzled beard gave him a general resemblance to an itinerant preacher. His companion Andrews was little more than a boy, frank-faced and cheerful, with the breezy manner of one who is out for a holiday and means to enjoy every minute of it. Both men were total abstainers and behaved in all ways as exemplary members of the society, with the one simple exception that they were assassins, but often proved themselves to be most capable instruments for the association of murder. Lawler had already carried out 14 commissions of the kind, and Andrews 3. Whoa. They just were super ordinary. They're abstainers. They seem really exemplary, except for being assassins.
Other than that,
the fatal flaw right there. We can say, you know, they don't mess with the devil's juice, but you know,
they murder people.
And yeah, we have to overlook some things. We all have something. and not only this paragraph says that not only do they abstain from alcohol and they're assassins, but they're very good at it, and they have a history of accomplishing their goals.
And it's interesting that Lawler looks like an itinerant preacher. So they have this sort of like middle class respectability about them. They don't look like miners who might be members of the secret society. These are guys who can infiltrate. So it seems like they're coming from outside to do a job in Vermissa Valley. And there will be an exchange. It's nice to have these exchanges, isn't it? You know, as someone who works at a university where we have wonderful exchange programs to learn about different cultures.
That's what you thought of was the exchange program? The cultural exchange of the assassins? Oh, dear. University of Connecticut's tougher than I thought.
Well, see the world. Kill a few people.
I'm so glad you never twist my words. Thanks.
McMurdo should probably follow their lead somewhere. I don't know why I feel that way.
Well, they do follow these two assassins. McMurdo and Scanlan together wake up really early. They hear that these guys are going out in the snow, and they don't close the door behind them. Struck me. Like, why would these two assassins leave the house and the detail of closing the door in the winter eluded them?
I don't know.
I don't know, okay. Steve. That is very fine. Important. We should note that down. The editor obviously made a mistake here.
It was very strange to me. Anyway, it was not yet dawn, and by the light of the lamps, they could see the two men some distance down the street. They followed them warily, treading noiselessly in the deep snow. There, the two assassins met three other guys, and they continued on to one of the local mines.
They went single file to hide their numbers.
When they get to the mine, they kill brutally two men. Wow.
And again, the description is way more graphic than what we have seen anywhere else in the canon.
Is this where they shoot him in the stomach and then he turns over to and they shoot him again?
Mm-hmm. Because he didn't quite die fast enough with a stomach wound. Whenever we're watching my wife's mystery shows and there's a stomach kill, I'm like, ooh, that is a bad way to go. So I was kind of relieved that they didn't just let him die slowly. But yes, this is an extremely graphic murder scene here.
And it's carried out in front of other miners. So the description here is, when a few of the bravest had rallied and there was a return to the mine, the murderous gang had vanished in the mists of morning without a single witness being able to swear to the identity of these men who, in front of 100 spectators, had wrought this double crime.
And that's real important there, too. I think that not only did they murder this person, it wasn't like they murdered him at his home. They murdered him in front of a whole group of people. So there is a lesson to be made there, too. This sounds very much like Chicago's crime there, Steve.
Again, this is organized crime. This is on purpose. They thought this through. They planned this out. And yes, there were 100 witnesses, but they were covering their faces with hats and their collars because it was cold in the winter, and they could not be identified. So we get to, there's one word that I want to talk about in this chapter, and that is the word sidewise. Doyle uses this word to describe how this man fell over. We don't say sidewise, we always say sideways. And it's never occurred to me that that might be just a misinterpretation with our American accents. I knew that the phrase, I couldn't get a word in edgewise, was always misinterpreted as edgeways, but I'd never considered sideways to be a mishearing of an English word. Isn't that interesting?
That is. I never thought about that either.
First time.
Well, he may have got it from the Younglings, Steve.
Well, I'm thinking of the movie Sideways, and it brings a whole new meaning to that movie because it's sidewise, but we just say it wrong. Interesting. Scanlan and McMurdo made their way back, Scanlan somewhat subdued, for it was the first murder job that he had seen with his own eyes, and it appeared less funny than he had been led to believe. The horrible screams of the dead manager's wife pursued them as they hurried to the town. No. McMurdo was absorbed and silent, but he showed no sympathy for the weakening of his companion. So for me, the hard-hitting part here is the image of the dead manager's wife screaming as these men are walking away from this scene.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And I find it interesting that Scanlan, who we don't know super well, but who's, you know, a bit of a hard character, he's really impacted by that, whereas McMurdo seemed not to be, mm-hmm. right? He showed no sympathy, and he goes back to this class war thing. It's a war between us and them, so we just have to hit back. He seems to have been somewhat brainwashed in terms of thinking, okay, we are completely separate from these people. It's not like we just killed someone who has a wife and family. It's like, that is the enemy. Mm. So he seems to have bought into the rhetoric of Bodymaster McGinty and this notion of, again, labor versus capital.
Mm. McMurdo gets his first murder assignment from McGinty. Ah, here comes that class idea and that us and them again, their justification for all of this action. McMurdo says, what's the man done? McGinty replies, didn't I tell you he shot Jim Carnaway? Why did he shoot him? What in thunder has that to do with you? Carnaway was about his house at night and he shot him. That's enough for me and you. You've got to settle the thing right.
By thunder.
There is a by thunder in there. You could tell these are Americans. That's what Doyle thinks of our language. And you don't need to have a justification for this. He hurt one of our guys. We're going to kill one of his guys. This is gang warfare.
Well, and it's interesting because Carnaway was about his house and he shot him. So we don't even have this clear sense that, I mean, he might have been trespassing or we don't really know what happened, but McMurdo's told, like, it's not your business. I told you to kill this guy. That's what you're going to do.
Yep. So McMurdo takes a sack of gunpowder, puts it at the door of this guy's house, and blows up the house. But alas, that work so well organized and boldly carried out should have all gone for nothing. Warned by the fate of the various victims and knowing that he was marked down for destruction, Chester Wilcox had moved himself and his family only the day before to some safer and less known quarters, where a guard of police should watch over them. It was an empty house which had been torn down by the gunpowder, and the grim old color sergeant of the war was still teaching discipline to the miners of Iron Dyke.
It was as if the leprechauns had come and informed them to move on.
Because the paragraph that we skipped over was that McMurdo was looking at the house the day before on his own to prepare for this crime. And then, it just happens that that guy moved out yesterday.
It's the luck of the Irish, Steve.
Not at all connected. He just moved out. We don't know why.
Now, we do learn that Wilcox is later assassinated by someone else. Mm-hmm. And then we're kind of reminded that, hey, we're not just reading a random novel. We are reading a story that John Douglas wrote when he was hiding in his little secret room, right? And so we get this sort of very third, I mean, it's all in third person, but this is unfocalized.
And all of a sudden, we've got a first person pronoun in this paragraph.
Such were the methods of the Society of Freemen, and such were the deeds of the Scourers, by which they spread their rule of fear over the great and rich district, which was for so long a period haunted by their terrible presence. Why should these pages be stained by further crimes? Have I not said enough to show the men and their methods? You're totally right. I had forgotten that not only does he pull back, he actually pulls back in first person. Mm-hmm. So I am showing you what happened here. I am showing you, says John Douglas.
Yeah, that is the first person pronoun in this part of this book. And reminding us that where this story is coming from. That is brilliant writing right there. That makes it all more real. It just all, Sherlock is real, Watson is real, and this guy really wrote this account of what really happened.
These are historical documents.
They're historical documents.
Exactly. I like it. Which brings us right to the ending of the chapter. Darkly the shadow lay upon the valley of fear. The spring had come with running brooks and blossoming trees. There was hope for all nature bound so long in an iron grip. But nowhere was there any hope for the men and women who lived under the yoke of the terror. Never had the cloud above them been so dark and hopeless as in the early summer of the year 1875. End of chapter. Whew.
Yeah.
The darkest hour, right? People feel totally hopeless as they get caught up in this. I like your use of the word gang war. Mm-hmm.
This is great writing. This is very gruesome, very out of norm for Sherlock Holmes. On purpose, Doyle is really working with the dime novel genre here and doing a really great job of it.
Yeah, you know, tomorrow when we talk about this, I think that we should look at Pam's middle name, Steve. What's her middle name?
Her middle name is Danger. That's why she's going back to school at the University of Connecticut with all the assassins who come in as exchange students, apparently. We've learned a lot this episode, Chip. Yes, tomorrow we will get to chapter 13, the title of which is Danger. So we will see even more danger happening in that chapter. But we are getting close to the end here. So it is time for us to hear from you. We would love to hear your top three favorite Sherlock Holmes stories out of the 60 of the canon that we are about to wrap up. We would love to hear from you. And we want to hear your list of your favorite tropes, the things that make a Sherlock Holmes story a Sherlock Holmes story. We will discuss those in the ending of this long journey that we've been taking daily, and then COVID will be over, which is good, so we can go back to school.
The end is near.
We would love to hear from you. Send us a voicemail, send us a text, send us an email, follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes, and go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all of these conversations over the entire canon. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore, welcoming you to the Valley of Fear.
All of you exchange student assassins.